Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now listeners, a call-in with a guest who we'll introduce in a minute, Alicia Garza, many of you know that name, that speaks to the police shooting of a Tatiana Jefferson and the circumstances of her tragic death. The 28-year-old, Texas woman was shot and killed inside her own home over the weekend. She was babysitting her 8-year-old nephew at the time. You've heard this story probably by now. That night, Tatiana was up late playing video games on an Xbox with her young nephew when she heard noises in the backyard. What she didn't know was that a neighbor had notified the police that her front door was open. The neighbor wasn't sure what was going on and was concerned. Officer Dean and another officer entered her property from the backyard before Dean fired that fatal shot through her back window. Here's the mayor of Fort Worth, Betsy Price, at a news conference yesterday.
Tatiana was a beautiful, smart, amazing young woman, by all accounts, who was unjustly taken from her family. To Tatiana's family, it's unacceptable. There is nothing that could justify what happened on Saturday morning. Nothing.
And late yesterday, news broke that the officer responsible, Aaron Dean, has been charged with murder and was later released on a $200,000 bond. Dean had just joined the police force last year. The shooting is also tragically similar to the shooting of Botham Jean in the nearby city of Dallas, Dallas-Fort Worth area. That's one metro. Jean was also shot in his home by off-duty police officer Amber Geiger, who says she mistook his apartment for hers, and we've talked about that on this show. So, listeners, what's your reaction to the shooting of a Tatiana Jefferson and the fact that this is the second high-profile police shooting of an innocent black person inside their home? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Anybody who's African-American, beyond the particulars of these two cases, how insecure does it make you feel, even inside your own home, given what police officers have now done in these two high-profile cases and everything else that I don't have to tell you from history and criminal justice context? So 212-433-WNYC, if people want to talk about the particular cases or kind of globally how this makes you feel in your own life. It was just last week that the dramatic trial and sentencing for the officer who shot Botham Jean unnerved many black Americans with the overwhelming display of love and forgiveness by members of the Jean family and the officer's relatively light sentence. Does this incident change anybody's mind about the aftermath of that case at all? Or is it irrelevant? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. I'm sure you're talking about this at home. I'm sure you're talking about this at work. And here's a chance for you to say something publicly about the particulars of these cases or just how it feels and how it affects you. Joining us for this call-in is the co-founder of Black Lives Matter and founder of the think tank, the Black Futures Lab, Alicia Garza. As you know, she came to prominence for activists, for her activism, I should say, and her work around police misconduct. Alicia, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome back to WNYC, and horrifying that it's under these circumstances.
Thank you for having me.
Let me start by getting your response to this clip from the Fort Worth Police Chief, Ed Krause.
I get it. We're trying to train our officers better. We're trying to shore up our policies, and we're trying to ensure that they act and react the way that the citizens intend them to, that they act and react with a servant's heart instead of a warrior's heart. There are times for officers to act as warriors and defenders, and there are times for them to act as public servants and humble servants.
So what are you thinking as you hear that clip, and what else do you want to say?
Well, I think it's important that we acknowledge that the conversation is changing. As we know, these kinds of incidents are not happenstance. They happen more frequently than we even hear about. And so often when we hear the responses from the police department, it is very different than what we heard yesterday. So we should acknowledge that there has been movement there. And in particular, I think what we started to see yesterday is actually really different than the response that we just heard. And so one of the things that we started to see was what I would call a playbook of response from law enforcement when these kinds of shootings happen. And the first thing that tends to happen is there tends to be a demonization of the person who was murdered. And so as you all know, this happened on Saturday, and as soon as Sunday hit, there was a story that was starting to build steam that Tatiana had a gun in her home. Now, of course, these officers had no way of knowing that. They weren't there for a call around a gun in the home, and it's not illegal for her to have a gun in the home, so it really didn't matter. They were there for a wellness check. I think what we started to see was that these departments start to understand that they don't want the on-the-street pressure from, you know, organizations and organizers who are going to push them to respond in a different way. And so I think this response was actually important, and we should acknowledge that there was movement there. I think it's also important for us to understand a broader context around policing that we're not actually talking about. One of the things that we have to understand is that right now, the system of policing that we have makes it so that we deploy people with guns to deal with a whole range of issues that don't actually require those levels of responses. A wellness check to make sure that somebody is okay. A mental health check, right? Somebody's having a mental health crisis. We deploy officers for things like that. And the reality is that those are not appropriate responses to deal with those problems. And so really we have to have a larger conversation about what policing is for and what it is not for. Of course, there are conversations happening around the country that are asking us, you know, whether to reconsider whether or not policing is necessary or useful. I know for a lot of people that might be a far way to go, but I want to acknowledge that that's a part of the conversation that's happening. But a bigger thing that I think we've got to really deal with when it comes to Tatiana's case is what happens from here. You know, I think that the response yesterday was very important, the response from the mayor, you know, really actually apologizing on behalf of that administration, the response from the police department, you know, saying, okay, we get it. There's, you know, training and things that have to happen. But I also think that we've got to be really clear that we're in a particular moment where we have an opportunity to make some real choices. And again, these are not isolated incidents. These are incidents that happen very regularly. And so there's three things that I would offer that are important as this case moves forward. One of these things is something I already mentioned, which is decoupling policing from a lot of the functions that we are deploying police for right now. Police are not trained in the ways that they need to be to deal with mental health crises and et cetera. But not only that, police are deployed to deal with those types of problems because we have deeply disinvested in the infrastructure that we actually need to deal with community problems. So that's one thing. Mm-hmm. The second thing, I think, is the demand that is coming from the family, which I think is very important, about an independent investigation. It is true that we need to have more mechanisms in the interim to be able to assess without politics, right? Mm-hmm. What happened here and what should have happened and what should the consequences be? And so, yes, it is important to have an outside monitor or someone like that that is a checks and balances to the police department themselves. And I agree full-heartedly with the family when they say that the police department cannot be trusted to oversee itself in these kinds of cases. So that is important. However, I do just want to say that There is a call also for a federal investigation, which I do think is important, to look for civil rights violations. But we should remember, right, that the Department of Justice is overseen by somebody who it's not likely that they will deploy resources in such a way to really manage what needs to happen in this case.
In fact, they've been systemically pulling back from federal oversight of local police departments, even that have been found to have systemic racism and other violations of public rights.
That's correct. And they have also been defanging the Office of Civil Rights that is inside of the DOJ that is supposed to be overseeing these types of cases. And so we should be mindful, right, when we think about things like this, that if we want change to happen, that voting actually does matter, right? Who we put in the White House, right, does impact who oversees the Department of Justice. And that impacts how it is that we monitor and oversee police departments and their practices across the country.
Yeah. Federal and local elections matter, right?
Correct.
Who we put into office that trickle down at various levels to police behavior from policy. Lloyd in Jersey,
right.
You're on WNYC with Alicia Garza. Hi, Lloyd.
Well, good morning. I can say that Alicia's right on point, and I would borrow everything that she said. Now, what I'd like to add to what she said is that as a citizen and a veteran who served on active duty for 6 years, I see police almost, they're demonstrating to me almost like video game responses to these kinds of calls. I mean, I think we need better screening of applicants as to their emotional state of minds or what they could be when they're faced with what might be stressful events. And this was like a low range event. I mean, I can't see it being a more peaceful thing than this, doing a wellness call and under the circumstances that the news is reporting. This guy just fired like right away, like he was playing a video game. This is a shame. This is a shame.
Lloyd, thank you. And, you know, one of the things, Alicia, that jumps out at me as a commonality that's really important, I think, in the Dallas and the Fort Worth case, is that in neither case, correct me if I'm wrong, did the police officer identify themselves as a police officer?
That's correct. In neither case did we see that. And we'll be looking to find out more of the background of the career of the officer, right, who I believe was hired into that police department in 2017. What we found in the Botham Jean case, right, was that Amber Geiger, was engaged in a whole range of inappropriate conduct as an officer, from her comments, during a Martin Luther King parade, right, to other comments that she made about Black people. This question about screening is important, and I think on the one hand, we do need to make sure that if people are employed in these professions, that they are equipped with the emotional capacity to be able to do so. But I will also say that for me personally, I can say that without a complete and fundamental restructuring of how policing happens in this country, it is always going to attract both people who want to help other people, right? Mm-hmm. But also people who deeply, I think, feel that there is a problem, right, with crime and violence,
right,
and that they
yeah.
want to deal with that problem.
And
oftentimes crime and violence is looked at as something that is a Black and brown problem and not a question of a lack of resources,
right,
or a lack of access to the things people need.
And I think most or all police departments in this country have psychological screening. They have sort of character, at least psychological profile fitness methodologies. I don't know if you've looked into it enough to determine that in many cases they are not enough, or they are leaving specific things out that would, elicit racial coding in a white police officer's or any police officer's psychological profile. Do you have any thought on that?
I think what often happens is that it's not so much about this initial psychological screening as it is about the pressures of the job itself. And police officers being deployed to do things that they are not trained to do, nor are there resources available for them to do it correctly, adds a level of strain and pressure that they don't actually get support for. And so what we find is that under pressure, right, that level of wanting to make a thing different, but, you know, not being able to do that, but being told that that is your job, adds a level of pressure on an individual that then is not supported inside of police departments. And so that is often where we see these kinds of breaks happen.
We're talking about the Dallas and Fort Worth police shootings with Alicia Garza, a co-founder of Black Lives Matter and founder of the think tank, the Black Futures Lab. And with you on the phones, with your reactions to the individual cases, and just with respect to your life as a person in this country, especially if you're Black, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. Alicia, I want to read you two tweets that have come in that say similar things that are heartbreaking and chilling. With respect to the place of innocent people in society when they may feel in danger. So here's one that came in that says, for me personally, I won't ever call the cops to my home, simply. And another one says, I do not know how to be a citizen or to feel American when I can't call the police for myself and others in need. What's your reaction to those things?
I mean, these are things that I think a lot of us feel. I know in my community, I also don't call the police. One, because I am deeply afraid of what the outcome will be. But two, because in my community, the police don't actually come even if you do call. And so there is this kind of dual dynamic that happens. I live in Oakland, California. I think that what is deeply heartbreaking to me is that there is this underlying current for Black people in this country where we don't feel safe and we don't feel protected. And in fact, we feel hunted. And that is what I feel whenever I turn on the TV and see another case like Botham Jean or like a Tatiana's case, where these are Black people who are sitting in their home, watching television, eating ice cream, playing video games with their nephew, Black people who are walking to the store for Skittles and an iced tea, Black people who are knocking on doors for help in the middle of the night when we get into an accident. We cannot be safe anywhere. And so I do think that it calls into question, how do we reframe and reshape what safety looks like? And are police and law enforcement at the center of that? I think that's an important conversation for us to have moving forward.
What's an alternative? I mean, if somebody's really, you know, being victimized by a crime, if somebody's in immediate physical danger or other reasons that people call the police that are urgent, are you suggesting there might be an alternative to that?
I'm suggesting that in communities like mine, where even when things like that are happening and you can't call the police because they don't come, that people who are in deep, tight-knit community figure out how to take care of each other. I'm suggesting that the deep disinvestment in services and infrastructure to be able to deal with people's needs is what actually creates these kinds of problems. And I'm also suggesting that a deep investment in that level of infrastructure that takes care of people's needs would actually have a corresponding output, which would be a different level of crime, harm, and violence. The reality is that crime, harm, and violence happens in every community. But what's not happening in the Upper West Side or in elite communities where I live is white people being killed in their homes by police officers after wellness checks. Yep. What's not happening in elite and resourced communities is white people being killed for going to the store to get an iced tea. So really what I'm suggesting is that essentially the way that policing happens in this country, whether it's in Fort Worth, Texas, or whether it's in Oakland, California, is embedded in racism. And what I'm suggesting is that in communities that are deeply disinvested in, we have higher incidences, right, of police abuse and police violence, and that those things are correlated and connected, and we need to do a deeper investigation about why in order to get to the solution about what to do about it.
Uju in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hello, Uju.
Yeah, hi. Hi, how are you? Long-time listener. I'm actually shocked I got through, so thank you for entertaining me this morning.
So glad you're on.
Okay, just a heads up, I'm actually with my son, so if you hear like a baby, that's just him, you know, doing what babies do. So I told the screener, so I'm actually Nigerian, and what happened over the weekend is just another indication of how unsafe I feel every single day living in this country. So when you from my Nigerian experience, you come to this country, you're told you put your head down, do things right, and all will be well. And you sort of, see what happens with the black community, and you say, oh, it's just them, it won't happen to us. We moved in 1996, right, around the time of Abner Nguema. I'm sorry if I'm saying his name wrong.
Yes, that's right.
And then shortly after that, my mom got sick, and she would cramp up really, really bad. She's a registered nurse. And she sent my brother outside, the bodega to go get a banana because that was the only thing open at 11 o'clock at night to help her. And all of a sudden, my brother fit the description, and he almost got killed that night. And if it wasn't because, people around the neighborhood were screaming, no, 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 they're Africans, they're good, my mom raced down the stairs and insisted that that she go with the police officers to the station. And it turns out that the description of the person they were looking for was 5'4". My brother is 6'1". Mm. He had a gray hoodie on. The person they were looking for had a red hoodie on. But because he was black, that's all they needed, right? So, and it's just crazy because the narrative is always, well, if you do what they tell you, you'll be fine. Okay, well, do what they tell you, they still kill you. If you don't make any sudden movement, you'll be fine. You do that, they still kill you. And it's crazy because I recently just had a son, as you can hear. I'm black, my husband is white, and, we've talked about, him understanding things as far as privilege is concerned, so he definitely has come around, because before it's just like, what do you mean? I don't understand it. And when I was pregnant, and while we were dating, I told him, I said, babe, I don't know if this country deserves me to contribute to the population, because I feel like whoever I have, they're going to kill them, because it doesn't matter if it's a boy or a girl, they kill you regardless. Mm. And he said, oh, I don't think you should live in fear, blah, blah, blah. So we got pregnant, and we finally found out we were having a boy. Obviously, Joshua was ecstatic and excited. But that moment, my heart literally sank. Because I told them, I said, they're going to take our son from us. They're legitimately going to take our son from us. And before, it was like, oh, babe, don't worry about it. We'll be fine. But after what just happened on Sunday, he just looked at me and he said, this is unbelievable. She was in her house. What else can you do? If you cannot even feel safe in your own house, there's literally no solution.
And a female who, to your point,
exactly,
should be less at risk statistically.
Exactly. So my thing is, how are women now all of a sudden targets? So, the one thing could be, okay, well, everyone has the stereotypical black man and King Kong and this, that, and the third, fine. But a woman, and it turns out that woman, my sister, my younger sister, went to Xavier University with her. So she knows her. She's the sweetest person. I mean, it's just heartbreaking because you cannot legitimately be in your own house. And we recently moved here in Harlem. The person who used to live in our house, for whatever reason, the police keep on knocking on our door to figure out, if she's still here. My husband has called them and said, please do not bang on our door. We have an infant son. And every time that I've been home and they've banged on the door, my heart literally is racing so fast. Like, I am just shaken, literally shaken.
And they keep coming to your door and banging on your door?
Banging on our door looking for some woman who used to live here. And I told them one time when they did it, I was home with him. He was just recently born at them. He was 2 months old. And he was taking a nap, and it freaked him out. I'm sorry, honey. And I said, please go away. Like, do not, they said, what's your name? I'm like, I'm not giving you my name. My name is downstairs in the sink. And my husband called and said, did you realize that my wife sometimes stays home without son? You can't do this.
And Uju, I got to go for time.
Okay, but I understand.
You should call back Friday and ask the mayor. About,
yeah, I know. I've been trying, but totally. I don't work Fridays, and I would totally do that because this has to stop. Because after this happened, we're not safe.
Because if they know, and if they know at the precinct that the previous person doesn't live there anymore, somebody should be able to call them off. Can I ask you one thing on a lighter note?
Right.
Since your baby just became the latest in a long line of babies to make their radio debut on the Brian Lehrer Show.
Yes. Do you want to say hi?
Yeah. What's your baby's name? What? Hello, baby boy. but Uju, what's your baby's name? Oh, I think she's talking to the kid, and now I can't hear. Oh, and then the line went dead. Okay. Anyway, Uju, thank you for your call. And hello, baby. You were on the radio. And this is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio. I'm going to take one more call for you, Alicia. I think Uju's story can stand on its own and probably doesn't even need a comment from you, but I want to take one more that I think does before we're completely out of time. Bill in Rego Park, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, thank you for putting me on the air. My immediate visceral reaction to your introduction was to think of a recent notorious video shown at a property owned by the President of the United States, and among the images of that in that video is someone looking like the President of the United States shooting people representing Black Lives Matter in the head, and there hasn't been a peep from the President of the United States about that video.
That's right, and I heard former prosecutor Paul Butler say on television yesterday that the President's silence, even though he didn't produce that video, it was in support of his campaign, but his campaign did not produce that video. But the fact that it was screened at a pro-Trump event and the president with the dozens or who knows how many by now of tweets that he has issued on other things has not personally tweeted to denounce that silence, according to Paul Butler, is an ongoing act of incitement to violence. So, Alicia Garza, as a co-founder of Black Lives Matter, I'm sure you have a reaction to that.
I do. I mean, let's be honest. I think that this president uses violence and manipulation to please his followers. And a lot of the rhetoric around Black Lives Matter is that, I mean, we hate law enforcement. And it's just actually not true. And to say that in this context where you have Black people sitting in their homes, minding their business, and being shot and murdered by police, and to not have any other response than, well, Black Lives Matter hates law enforcement, is a little bit ridiculous. And 5 years later, 6 years later now, you would think, right, that we wouldn't have to keep explaining over and over again what the problem is. But just in case we still need to, I will just say this. What is important for us to understand, as somebody who, you know, has law enforcement in my family, you know, my mother was a corrections officer for many years, I can tell you that the issue here is a systemic issue. It is not about individual people. Lots of us have law enforcement members in our families who we love, our aunties, our uncles, our brothers, our sisters. That's not the point. The point is that we have a system, a profession that is it's charged with keeping people safe. That's what we tell each other, and that's what we tell ourselves. And yet, incident after incident after incident, Black people, brown people, poor people are being shot and killed by police across this country, and nothing is changing about it. That is the issue that we have to deal with. We have to deal with the racism that is embedded in policing as a function in our society. And we have to deal with how we keep people safe and how we keep people alive and how we deal with problems differently. That is the mission and the focus of these movements. And yes, our job is to challenge preconceived notions that just to tinker with a thing is going to make it better. Tinkering with training is not going to stop Black people from being murdered. Public apologies, right, are not going to stop Black people from being murdered. We have to have systemic change, which means that we have to investigate how systems function. We have to investigate why they function that way in order to actually transform those systems into things that can work for everybody.
Alicia Garza, a co-founder of Black Lives Matter and founder of the think tank, the Black Futures Lab, thank you as always.
Thank you so much for having me.